History of buildings.
With.
Another week already?
You wanted to wait for the second week?
We're going to start off with opening a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 411. We'll do that and. Oh, sorry, Richard. We're going to temporarily close on 411. Which bill would you like?
133, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 133.
Can you hold him to an hour or less?
Can I hold him to an hour or less? Well, you know how Richard is. Come on up, Richard. Excuse me, Senator. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 133 authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to enter an agreement with public bodies to allow access to public bodies' construction-related services through department's electronic building codes information system. Enables information system to include coordination and tracking of construction-related services. Removes sunset and building permit surcharges used to fund operation of electronic building code system. There are no revenue or fiscal impacts with Senate Bill 133 and no amendments.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I'm here to urge you to send Senate Bill 133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. SB 133 removes the sunset on the funding mechanism for and makes a few other technical changes to Oregon's e-permitting system for builders and other contractors. E-permitting allows contractors to apply, pay, and receive building permit approvals online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's an IT program that has been operating successfully for 6 years. I want to repeat that. It's an IT program that has been operating successfully for 6 years. More local jurisdictions are using the system each year. 54 cities and counties are on board so far, with several more in process. It's a voluntary system. Cities and counties can choose to participate or not to participate. The Building Codes Division, its local government partners, and the private sector users strongly support e-permitting. Reauthorization of this program requires no increase in fees, staff, or budget for the Building Codes Division. I encourage you to pass SB 133 and continue this successful program. On your desk, you have a letter from many of the supporting entities. If you can find anyone that's not listed that has some association in the private sector with building, let me know, because they'll probably sign on also as a supporter of this legislation. It's a good piece of legislation. It's a relatively straightforward. We do understand that there may be a little bit of need for some wordsmithing, a couple of things that may come apparent in the rest of this hearing. Mr. Chairman, I'll give you my assurances that the groups will work together if there is some concerns, and we'll come back to you with a bill in a week or two that has those concerns addressed. So hopefully this can be passed on to the Senate floor. Again, the bill has no fiscal, so I will not see it in Ways and Means.
Question, Senator.
This is all voluntary, is it not?
Yes.
Thank you. Again, this is all voluntary, is it not?
Yes.
I'm supposed to get that in three times, so somebody else will ask this.
I believe, didn't you say it was voluntary?
Yes, it's voluntary.
Okay, we've done our job.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator? No. Did you have a question, Senator Monroe?
No, I'm.
Didn't you wonder
great
if it was
bill.
Voluntary?
I can assure you it's voluntary.
This is overkill now.
All right, thank you, Senator.
Thank you much.
All right, we'll go ahead. I only have two people signed up on this, so we'll see who else shows. Well, actually, maybe there's more. Mr. Long, do you have some people with you? Ted? I can't read the last name. And Rich Mead?
Could I get... also, the sign-up sheet got taken. Could I get Judge Grast, who came here from Harney County, to come up to the
door? Oh, okay.
Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Steve.
Good Long.
Yeah.
I understand you've brought us a voluntary bill.
Yes, sir. It's a good bill, Senator. It's a good program. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. I probably won't cover ground that's already been covered. What I will do is talk about the elements that are in Senate Bill 133 that we put in based on our experience to date working on this program. My involvement in regulatory streamlining and working to make the building code system work better through an electronic means goes clear back to 2003. Of course, the primary legislation that we're asking to have the sunset removed was passed in 2007. What we've learned working with our 50-some current city-county partners across the state representing medium-sized counties, cities, carrying out building inspection programs is that we need to have stability of the service that we provide, continuity of the service, so it's really important to kind of keep this program going. Folks that are thinking about coming on, ask those questions. Is it going to be here tomorrow? And we need to be able to tell them that it is. We're moving towards greater use of applications, field work, you know, tablets, all those different kinds of things. We're constantly learning about the new services that our contractors need and our inspectors need and our communities need, and we're great thing about this program is it's flexible to meet those needs. You'll hear potential comments about the word construction-related. We added that in the bill. That's to allow us to provide a variety of services to a community. These folks can kind of talk about how important that is to a local community to tie in maybe with your land use or some other future construction-related component that needs to be carried out on a local basis, and we want to make sure we have the ability to offer those services. Again, it's voluntary, so if they don't like the service that we have or the program, of course, they don't select it. We think regional efforts are really important, especially in our rural areas. And I think Commissioner Grassley will talk about this, but if any of the things that we do at Building Codes, you know, electronic services and getting things into the World Wide Web allows our it reduces the distances that occur out there in eastern Oregon or parts of southern Oregon, parts of the of Oregon, and really I think helps the building department provide those services, and it reduces travel for our contractors and gives them predictability when they're going from spot to spot. So this is a customer-driven system. I'd just let my customers talk about it, and I'll be here to answer any questions that anybody has.
Thank you. Any questions of Mark before I move on? Seeing him, go ahead.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Steve Grasty, Harney County Judge. It's always a joy to be on the side of the state this time of year. I was pretty tickled not to deal with the snow on the way over, so thanks for helping with that. So Mark's right. This has been an amazing system for our county, and we haven't been on it all that long, but it's really handy to be able to see one of our electricians get called out at night. They can go online, get the permit, go do the service. In the past, odds were they were never going to buy the permit, so it actually drives a little bit additional revenue. Without a doubt, it's voluntary. We looked at this for quite a while, saying, is this the right thing? It's absolutely the right thing in the middle of it. I recognize there's a couple of terms in this bill that are questionable, and Mr. Long has touched on those. Having the flexibility to say, should we connect septic system permits when a plumber's online getting his plumbing permit anyway, and the next thing he's going to go get is another permit. It just makes sense for this to be broader than simply building codes. And I think as time goes along, this will probably grow. I checked with contractors in our county, could not find any who were opposed to the 4%. They see this as a small fee to really be able to provide themselves with the simple, quick way to get permitting done. And then finally, we see a lot of opportunity because Mr. Long travels through Harney County a lot, and we keep looking for an opportunity for our sheriffs to pick up some additional revenue from him as he drives through, but hasn't occurred yet. But thanks for your time.
Thank you. Could you move the mic over, please?
Okay. My name is Richard Mead. I'm the building official for the city of Forest Grove, and we also do the permitting and inspections for the city of Cornelius. We are just now going into training to come online to start this program. And one of the reasons that we actually are doing it is because our current permitting program is no longer being serviced through Eden. And we were shopping around, and, you know, it was $100,000 plus to get a new permitting program to do it. from everything we talked to people that are on the state system right now, it was all positive. So that's why we're going with it. And that's allowing us also to, you know, hire another part-time person, too, so we can, you know, refocus funds in more different ways. We are looking forward to the, you know, the service that we can give our contractors and our citizens, because being able to go online and schedule your inspections, buy your permits, it is, you know, I think it'll raise the level of customer service that we are able to provide right now, and that's what we're really striving for. You know, we're not a big jurisdiction, but, you know, we still would like to be able to supply, you know, superior service, and that's what we're trying for.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, I do have a couple others. Senator Devlin mentioned some possible word changes. Mark, is there something you're aware of there?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, again, I've been made aware that some folks may be uncomfortable with the word construction-related. We think it's fine. We think any attempt to define that or narrow that would impact our ability to serve Steve's community down the road, Rich's community down the road, or any of the other community. The great thing about the program that we put together is, again, it's flexible and scalable. It's voluntary. And so that we can, if Steve wants to connect in a DEQ permit for his septic system, we put the word public body in there so we could think about that. And it's construction related so that, again, we can meet all those services. So from my opinion, I think the bill's good to go, and I urge your pass.
I know there's a general fee that's assessed across the board on all permits to help fund the department. Would that have any impact on that if one was doing something beyond just a straight-up building permit?
Chair Beyer, there's a surcharge that's currently charged. The bill codifies that at 4%. The current rate is up to 5, so we've determined that 4 we think is the right number. Yes, you have to be careful that you don't have a problem with scope creep or get out of alignment. So we obviously want to make the commitment to our community partners that we can work on other things that are construction related, but the revenue, what the vendor can do, how complex the issue will determine what level of service we can provide to the community. And again, it's kind of voluntary. I think it's very important, though, when we go to work with Forest Grove and Cornelius and some of the others, especially on the land use component, where they need to track those permits. Right now, they'll be able to pull up an address once we get them on and see their building permit activity and their land use permit activity all in the same place. If I can figure out a way to do that for a septic permit over in Harney County, we'll do that as well. And then I'm open to anything else that we're able to put into the system that would work for the community. So hopefully I answered your question.
But to be clear, if you did that construction activity in Forest Grove, that would not, and if it's 4% of whatever that was, that would not influence the other cities that are managing.
Not at all. Not at all.
What they would pay.
Chair Beyer, there's a base software system, a base product that we provide, and then we can configure. I'm not going to say. It's a basic commercial off-the-shelf product that we can configure to provide those additional services if we can provide them within the constraints of the software system. We can configure that up, and it's individual to each community.
Okay.
We would want to standardize it, though, so that what Rich uses in Forest Grove would be the same in Cornelius, so that the customers are familiar with that, and the permit techs and the employees and all that. We think that that's the way to do it. But whether Steve wants to use that service or not, he doesn't have to.
Okay.
And if you don't need septic approvals, you wouldn't have to use that. I don't think you do that right?
No.
So that's why we've drafted the bill the way we had, is to provide us maximum flexibility since it is voluntary and try to look at what might come down the road in the future to meet the needs of the communities.
It's more of a service model.
Absolutely.
Other question?
Not a question, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley, yes.
Since I was the one who created this bill back in 2007, and I think it's a great bill that was created.
So I shouldn't say it's your fault.
You should say it's my fault. And I think these little expansions and the taking the sunset off are great ideas. So.
Okay. Senator Bell?
Yeah, Mark, you said this voluntary bill would be helpful to rural parts of the state. Would that include, like, the mid-Willamette Valley, say, around Staten and maybe Hood River?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think we have Marion County using the system, and Hood River is coming up next. So absolutely, as well as Harney County, Malheur County. There should be a list in front of you of the 35 people that are using the full system and then the 20 customers that are using the original pilot. So, and we're expanding. We're adding a community. We're adding about one community a month right now.
Cool. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. I have three other people who've indicated they want to speak. Inga Deckert, Elizabeth Edwards, and Aaron Doyle. If you'd like to come on up, that'd be great. Welcome, and comment on this voluntary bill. Having a little fun today.
I guess since I'm in the middle, I'll go first. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, I suppose, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Deckert. I'm here this afternoon testifying on behalf of two of my clients. One is the City of Hillsborough, and the other is the Oregon Building Officials Association, OBOA. City of Hillsborough is pretty self-explanatory. OBOA represents more than 1,000 local building officials and personnel across the state. They're located in large metropolitan areas as well as smaller, more rural jurisdictions. In most jurisdictions, the statewide building code is administered and enforced by the local departments. In jurisdictions where the local city or county departments do not want to assume the responsibility for administering the code, the state Department of Building Codes does so. In 2007, as was mentioned, House Bill 2405 was passed, which enabled DCBS to start an e-permitting pilot project for building codes. That pilot is to sunset in 2018. The current e-permitting system is used by and provides value to many of OBOA's members, particularly those who are in smaller, more rural jurisdictions. These jurisdictions that choose to use it for these OBOA supports the continuation of the current program. OBOA and the City of Hillsborough have concerns, however, about the expansion of and other changes to the program that are proposed in Senate Bill 133. It's because of these concerns that we cannot support the passage of the bill as drafted. And as was mentioned earlier by Senator Devlin, we're happy to work with the proponents to try to work out some language that is satisfactory to both sides. So quickly, specifically, the bill does three things: removes the 2018 sunset date. It expands the program beyond building codes to include, as we heard, all construction-related activities, and it also locks into statute a 4% state surcharge on building permits. So OBOA and the City of Hillsborough have questions and concerns about the expansion of the program, as well as locking a 4% surcharge into statute. And that would be a change in the law to allow building permit surcharges to support services and programs that are unrelated to building permits. So under expanding the program, under law, the e-permitting system is currently limited to building code information and services. As we've heard, Senate Bill 133 would expand that to all construction-related services. That term's not defined in statute. We've heard reference to planning and some other types of permits, but we would like to see either a definition of that or have more of a discussion about what the entire scope of that could look like so that my clients can understand the scope and determine what impact there may be on their operations. And with respect to the permit surcharges, The state currently imposes a variety of surcharges on building permits. Those surcharges, the total of that is 12%. 4% of that 12 is for the e-permitting system. The local building departments collect these surcharges from their customers at the counter every day, and they field questions from their customers about what the surcharges are used for, why the amounts are what they are, and what activities they fund. Funds derived from these surcharges currently under law are used solely to support the state's administration and enforcement of the building code. Since Senate Bill 133 expands beyond building codes to include all construction-related services, we wonder what funds are going to be used to pay for that. Are we making a policy choice of changing current law so that the surcharges on the building permits can be used to pay for other services that are non-building permit related, or are there some other funding source that's being contemplated that just hasn't been discussed yet? Enhancing economic development is a major consideration for our local building departments. They work diligently to keep their building permits fees down as not to inhibit growth and economic development in their local communities. Therefore, they have concerns about locking a 4% surcharge in statute, particularly since there hasn't been much of a discussion and since this bill is not slated to go to Ways and Means about how much is being collected under the surcharge statewide now. What are the current expenses related to the e-permitting system as it relates to just building codes? And then if it were to expand, what would that look like? Is 4% the appropriate amount? There hasn't been a discussion of that yet, so we'd welcome that as well.
Inga, it sounds like you have some issues there. So what I'm inclined to do is to give you a week to work with Mr. Long and others to see if you can resolve these and come up with an amendment. And we'll put it back on in a week. But I don't want to shortchange the others. I'm just kind of, that's my inclination right now, because it sounds like you want to work on this.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the City of Portland. I would say thank you very much for the time to work on amendments. I'm going to echo much of what the City of Hillsborough said. We share many of their concerns about how this could potentially impact our e-permitting system and why this is moving forward at this time. As was mentioned, the sunset actually kicks in 2018. We have ample time to explore how much the cost of maintaining the system is, and I don't think that there is a rush to move extending or actually lifting the sunset entirely at this time. Moreover, to lift the sunset and then charge 4% in perpetuity seems a large step for the beginning of the second week of session. Also echo concerns about the definition of construction-related services and what that touches on. I think more clarity in the bill would be very much appreciated. And also, of course, it's been mentioned that the system is voluntary, and we're very supportive of it continuing to be voluntary. So wanted to put that on the record as well. Anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Of course, you know that every year when this assembly comes together, everything is subject to sunset.
Yes. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I had two main points. One is we appreciate that this stays a voluntary, I just thought I'd get it on there one more time, system. And I will say that I am one of the folks who have raised the concerns about the construction-related services. Now that I've started having the conversation with the department about what was intended and what our local governments are getting out of that system, I think there might be a better way of stating it, services being broader than other permitting. However, it sounds like it's a need to convince legislative council as well as getting the right language to describe what the services are. I am happy to have that week to do that, and I appreciate the chair offering that out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. Trivett and Mr. Weaver. Welcome.
Thank you.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett with PacWest, here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. NECA has supported the e-permitting system since before its inception, when it was just an idea. We're very supportive of the program now. And I thought everybody was. I was actually surprised after hearing some of Senator Devlin's remarks that anybody was actually opposed to the program going forward or had concerns about the way this bill was fashioned. The fees, in fact, are paid for by the contractors themselves, not local governments. And we have supported fee increases in the past for things that like better, faster inspections, better license enforcement. We believe the e-permitting program helps our the over 200 small businesses that make up our association make it more convenient when we interact with government. In 2015, we think the idea of having to have paper copies of everything and submit in person is sort of silly this day and age. It seems like that can be done online and be much more convenient for the businesses that need to interact with government. So we're very supportive of the bill as is and would like your affirmative vote.
I did note for the record that your letter, I think, has every conceivable committee organization, people who pay the fees, listed on it in support of this.
Yes. Morning. Good morning, or afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is Mike Weaver. I'm an electrical contractor in Albany, Oregon, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about this important voluntary program. sorry, I had to put that in there. As electrical contractors, we've used the e-permitted system for since the duration of its inception, and it has helped us streamline the permitting process greatly. Online permitting processes help us be more efficient in completing our work on time. Delays in construction processes cost everyone precious dollars and hurt economic development. We can purchase permits and schedule inspections 24/7 through the e-permitting system. E-permitting has helped us work more efficiently in rural areas of the state. We're able to pull permits and inspections from our desktops rather than having to make separate trips or move forward on projects. And I need to ad lib on that a little to my notes. We do quite a bit of work in rural project in rural areas, and when my ladies in the office call up to find out how to pull a permit for that area, and we find out it's e-permitting, they're ecstatic. There are so many different ways to pull a permit in the state of Oregon. It's quite ridiculous. Some jurisdictions require you to pay before you get the permit. Some require you to have a trust fund with money there ready to pay for the permit. Some jurisdictions require you to have a wet eek stamp. I'm the signing supervisor for our electrical contracting firm, and we cannot pull a permit in some jurisdictions until they have my stamp on that permit in their office, which delays the project immensely, and our contractors that we work for are very unhappy about that. We want to make sure that the system is adequately funded so there are no monies available to maintain flexible ways to improve contractor access to building permits and related services. Because we've been paying the surcharge on our permits to help the e-permitting system, we have skin in the game, and we like the e-permitting system and want to keep it moving forward.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. That's all I had on a sign-up sheet. Is there anybody else who wishes to address the committee on this bill? Seeing none, Mr. Long, would you please see if you could get a work group together to see if we can work out some of these issues or at least address them, see what you can do. And we will schedule it for next Monday for a work session. So we'll close on Senate Bill 133. Is that right? That's right. Mm-hmm. And we'll reopen on Senate Bill 411. Colleagues, I think we have a series of amendments on 411. When we held the public hearing the other day, we had a dash one, which is, if I'm correct, we never adopted, which is proposed as some technical things. And I believe we have a dash two and a dash three from Senator Gerard, the vice chair, which I think are being proposed by Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller, would you like to come up first and just kind of Come on up and hold still for a second. I think we're going to, just to unprocess, let's do the dash ones first, which are just the technical amendments. So the chair would move the dash ones to get us on, get the technical things into the bill. Discussion on the motion to approve the dash one amendments. Is there any opposition to the dash ones? All right, the dash ones are adopted. So now we're up to the dash twos and the dash threes. Let's do the dash twos first, and then we'll just go right on through what the two are, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association. And, you know, during the testimony, as you recall, there was two different issues within the bill, two different proposals. There's a UIM portion of the bill, and then there's PIP changes of the bill, and so that we went through. The dash two amendments are simple. It just removes the UIM portion of the bill, which is sections 1 through 3. You know, we obviously argued at the public hearing that puts a rate increase disproportionately onto lower income, those folks who actually have the minimum limits. And so the dash two deletes that and keeps intact the two PIP changes in the bill. The dash three amendment actually keeps the UIM portion of the bill. And then there's two different provision or changes in the PIP. This 1 year to 2 years, and the change in the bill that basically removes the word economic, and so that then it would include all non-economic or punitive damages. So the dash three amendment simply just deletes the section of the bill of the economic change, which then would put it back to simply, those of, economic damages. And so you would not be able to move beyond into non-economic or punitive damages. And so that's what the dash three amendment does. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions of Mr. Miller. Okay. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Mr. Towers, would you like to comment on him? Whatever.
There we go. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Thanks for the opportunity to come speak during the work session. I appreciate that. Just wanted to reiterate that the PIP portion of Senate Bill 411, as just now amended, doesn't change the amount of the payout. The key piece simply reorders who gets paid back first, and this would put the PIP carrier at the end of the line. And so that's the that is the big deal. We're talking about a sliver of the overall cases, of overall claims, and so really those are the points that I wanted to make. And we had a lengthy hearing about this the other day, and so I don't want to go into a lot more detail. But I'm, of course, happy to answer questions.
Any questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I did ask, because this is a very confusing piece here, and we obviously have differences of opinion, to ask the insurance division if they could help us understand this better and what the impact might be. And please, Ms. Gage.
Good afternoon, Chair Byers, members of the committee. My name is Gail Gage. I'm a senior policy analyst with the insurance division.
And so, you talked with me a little earlier about this, and just if you could kind of explain the difference of what the dash threes, what the effect of that would be.
The dash threes, what that would do is currently PIP benefits, there's subrogation that comes out of non-economic damages that have been awarded over and above economic damages. So the dash three, I'm sorry, the bill itself would not allow subrogation until after the economic and the non-economic damages. Dash three then puts it back to where it is, where they can subrogate against the non-economic damages.
So to be clear, the economic damages would be any medical cost, And anything's like loss of time, loss of wages, that sort of thing.
Mostly what you can put a dollar figure on, too.
Okay, and the non-economic would be pain and suffering kinds of things?
Right.
Okay, so they're more punitive damages.
I think punitive sits on top of that.
Okay. I think Art likes to describe it as the limp, pain for your limp.
The limp would be non-economic damages.
Okay.
As long as that limp isn't associated with the loss of pecuniary loss of wages.
And you shared with me a chart here that talked about what the cost is estimated by your actuaries, what the cost would be.
Yes. Well, that cost is if you took uninsured motorist coverage, UIM, and stacked it on top of what a person was able to get from a liability award from the at-fault driver. So that's what that one doesn't address the PIP issue.
Okay. How about PIP? Does that have a?
We didn't calculate that. That's certainly something.
Would that be in addition to the unemployed, the stacking?
Yes. I don't know how the numbers would crunch, but that's something.
In sense of proportionally, is it significant or not?
I don't know.
No idea. So the numbers, college. I'll pass this down. What they did is estimate what that cost would be in the. And it's a monthly cost, so I'll just pass it down.
It turns out it's a 6-month cost.
6 months.
I was wrong. It's a 6-month.
So 6 months, not monthly, but every 6 months.
Right.
Double it, and you get an annual cost. It, for the audience, it's a little over $6 at the minimum coverage every 6 months, so it's a fairly small number.
$20 a year.
Any other questions that you want? The insurance division, we've got an impartial group here. Senator Thompson?
I'd kind of like to know that number that we didn't ask her to research.
The PIP number?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll turn this back over to our actuary and ask him to calculate that for us.
My guess is it's less than that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a smaller portion. It'll be in addition to the $6, but probably not an additional 6, I would guess. Be something smaller than
way
that.
Way smaller.
And I will ask him to. This is just based on.
I have a question,
Senator. Did you get?
Let me see.
My question is: we heard from the industry, and the industry's numbers were different than yours by quite a bit. They're the ones that are going to be writing the policies. Why is there such a difference between the two?
I had asked my actuary to. We just had a few days where we threw this together. It was based off of the rate filings that have been placed with us from the largest carrier, which happens to be State Farm. So I asked him to fold in more companies than just that one, and I can provide that data, and it will probably show a larger increase, but I don't know that for sure. We'll know that when he's crunched the other numbers, because State Farm generally isn't in writing that many lower policies.
That's the key.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So this is likely sort of a middle of the road average.
Well, it's a low number.
It's a low number. I think it's probably a lower number, because we're going to get, once we fold in other companies that write more of these policies, I think we're going to see a bigger difference. But I'm not a numbers person.
This is a cherry pick.
A cherry. That surprises me. State Farm writes less of these?
Writes. That's my understanding, is that they are not a company that writes the majority. And I don't know. I may be speaking completely just off the top of my head, and I don't want to do that. But I understand that other carriers, each carrier has a target audience, and you're going to find it's different carriers that target the most expensive drivers.
It's going to be, it's like anything actuarially, it's going to be based on I assume it's proportional to whatever you're paying for your car insurance. So if you're a high risk, for whatever reason, you're going to pay more than if you're a low risk.
Correct. And there's so many things that go into defining what's a high risk. It could be just a bad credit score, or you're young, but you're a higher risk.
Okay. Other questions? Senator?
I guess I would just like to more know some better numbers than this. And if it's $6, I could maybe get to a yes, but we don't know if it's going to be 20 or 30 at this point.
Well,
so I don't know.
Mr. Towers is begging to speak here, and I think he's going to bring up a chart of what the other states are charging now. But I think it's fair to say that you'll never know that number because it's going to be determined by the actuaries in each insurance company, who they're targeting as a market, it'll vary by individual, mm-hmm. and what the competitive forces are. Sort of like, how much do they really want to write this, and how much money do they, how much profit do they want to make off of it? That's going to be the driver on it. So.
And what are other companies charging?
Well, as I said, competitive forces. Mm-hmm. And whether you've got 15 minutes or not to choose. Never mind.
I get you.
You get it. As Senator.
Just a comment. Just going back over my old notes, and State Farm is who you used as a source?
We got into the actual rate filings that have been filed with us, so we didn't approach State Farm for the information.
Because State Farm gave testimony that this would raise $55.
So, but they may have crunched numbers beyond just what State Farm does. That's what I don't know. So I'd be really happy to have our actuary put that back together so we have some closer numbers.
Senators, one of the things I thought it would be helpful because we have people who have different economic interests on the thing
yeah.
to bring over the insurance division, which doesn't have a dog in the fight. And actuaries are actuaries. It's just getting an actuary to say, what is it likely to be? Recognize, again, it's just a ballpark. Right. You can't get to the specific unless you're looking at specific companies go through the numbers. So. Other questions? Thank you very much. I think you have other issues up here today that we're going to be dealing with. All right. Ms. Towers, did you want to comment?
Chair Beyer.
You're on the edge of your chair, Art, so you want to make sure that everybody has their shot at it.
Chair Beyer, thank you. I'm just proud of myself for not knocking my chair over. The only other point I want to make is that the overall PIP premium is, if I look at my own auto insurance policy, the PIP premium is a sliver of the overall cost, my overall premium. So all I'm saying is that if it's a $6 increase for the other part, the increase on the PIP piece, you know, just mathematically doesn't feel like it should be a tremendous amount if the other one's $6 for 6 months. Thank
right.
you.
Mr. Miller, did you have another one? And Mr. Powell, since we were talking about your client, State Farm, did you? I want to give you the opportunity if you wanted to say something.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller again, Property Casualty Insurance Association. Looking back to when the insurance division did look at this issue in 2009, they did state, and this is under the PIP portion of the bill, that on the non-economic damages are negotiated and subjective in nature and make it difficult to quantify. And so you are going to have difficulty quantifying. I'm not right. disputing that. I think what we're saying is if you do raise the cost of PIP, and I know it's hard to, you know, compare state to state because a lot of states it's optional. And so this is a mandatory coverage in Oregon when we're comparing to what other states do, which it may be optional. So that's very difficult to compare as you look at the impacts. And so I just want to, you know, point that out, that is difficult and subjective. But, you know, you have your PIP coverage, no fault, then you had your liability, and then now fallback on your health insurance coverage when those limits are exhausted. So a lot of the testimony you heard, I think the last is the possibility of out-of-pocket expenses, and I think that's really minimized, and it's minimized in a way now while also trying to keep that cost, you know, low enough for consumers. So that'll be my only comment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. The real John Powell is in another meeting. I'm sorry he's not here.
Sorry to put you on the spot, John.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how to respond because I got lost in the insurance division testimony as to which section of the bill they were referring to.
It was it the UIM?
Was it the UIM?
Yeah.
Excess, making it excess?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll talk to them offline. We don't file that coverage in Oregon. We don't sell excess like that. We sell higher limits.
Yeah.
But you're talking two different languages there. One is putting the UIM on top of the other party's liability insurance versus difference of limits, which subtracts that. And that's the Georgia figures that you have in the document we submitted. They're straight from the manual, and they would be similar to that in a state like Oregon. So that's all I can say.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman.
Anything else from committee? Already? Senator?
Are you in work session?
We are in work session.
I move the dash two amendments.
Senator Girard has moved the dash two amendments. Senator, second. Any comments?
Second.
We don't do that, Senator.
Thank you. The UIM, I think you solved the problem, not me, but most of the Democrats put in Cover Oregon. Cover Oregon would become the medical insurance that would be stacked. What you're doing here is rewarding the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers are the ones making the money on this, not the individual. The individual, if they are insured, that's their secondary carrier. So I think this is a really good measure, and I stand behind it. So I support the dash twos.
I'm going to be a no on this amendment. I just
disagree.
I disagree.
Yes. Anybody else? Would you like to call the roll, please?
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Girard?
Yes.
Chair Beyer?
No. The motion fails. Senator,
I'm on a roll. I'll move the dash three amendment.
I won't check.
Senator has moved the Senator Rudd has moved the dash three amendments.
Dash three amendments takes the insurance from economic to
excess.
Yes. So this is what it is. It pays for pain and suffering, which is part of the policy they've never paid for in the past. Again, this just increases the settlements, which increases the rates, which increases the contingency fee for the trial lawyers. So I think it's a good bill and should pass.
Amendment.
Sorry.
Further discussion on the amendment? None? Well, then let's call the roll.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Girard?
Yes.
Chair Beyer?
No. The amendment fails. We're on to the main motion. Any discussion on the main motion? The main motion is the bill as amended by the dash ones. Let's call the roll.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Riley?
Yes.
Vice Chair Girard?
No.
Chip Beyer?
Yes. Senate Bill 411 as amended by the dash ones is moved to the floor. With a due pass, we'll ask Senator Gelser to carry. We'll close on that.
Mr. Chair, I want to serve notice of a minority report.
And Senator has served notice of minority report. All right, so we're going to move next to, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 317. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 317 prohibits insurers from offering policy that provides the insurer a right that is superior to the right of insured to interpret terms of policy or that specifies a standard for interpreting that is inconsistent with state laws. Requires insurance policy to include clause asserting conformance to Oregon Insurance Code, to state that the insurance code is incorporated in policy by reference, and to declare any policy provisions in conflict are superseded by insurance code. Declares emergency, effective on passage, becomes effective 91 days after effective date of measure. We do have a dash two amendment that designates failure to provide reimbursement required under Oregon Chapter 743A as an unfair claim settlement practice under ORS 746 2.230 that has a minimal fiscal impact and a non-revenue impact. We also have a dash 3 amendment, which modifies the operative date from 91 days after passage to January 1st, 2016. That has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, and I can't recall, is this an agency bill? No. Well, I'm just going to go down the list then. Megan, is it Lohr? I'm not really sure.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm a Portland lawyer, and I represent consumers in claims mostly for denied health benefits and to some extent into disability benefits under group and individual policies. The first and most critical point I want to make to you is that which will be also discussed in other testimony to this committee, as I understand it, is that the insurance division has already banned these discretionary clauses. The insurance division did so back in 2004, approximately 10 years ago. There hasn't been adequate compliance with the ban, and that's why a statute is needed. In my materials, I have shown you a case on point. I litigated a case against a disability carrier, Unum, that issued a policy in the state of Oregon. Despite the ban, checked off on its forms that there was not a discretionary clause in the policy when there was. When we litigated the case in court, Unum argued that, well, the insurance division has approved our forms over and over again, therefore they must be just fine. That's why the inability of the insurance division, the lack of resources to enforce the ban and to check line by line through all the forms is the reason a statute is needed, is one of the reasons. My second point is that SB 317 should not be controversial. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners unanimously passed the model ban back in 2001. More than 20 states have followed and have either by statute, by rulemaking, or by decree of the commissioner in their state have banned discretionary clauses. I also want to explain as a practical matter what these discretionary clauses do, what impact they have. Because it's not really clear, you read this, what does this mean? The insurance company has discretion, and I'll give you a typical case in the medical context. Woman is denied a treatment for brain cancer, for a surgery that's necessary. And she appeals that decision, as she is required to do, back to the insurance company that issued the policy. Because the insurance company then denies the claim. Because many, if not most people in this state, obtain their health insurance through private employers, through group insurance, the federal law of ERISA governs these claims. The case proceeds to federal court, where a federal judge does a cold record review. In other words, there is no jury trial. There are not experts. The judge never meets the claimant. Instead, the judge reviews the record. And in many cases, the record consists of nothing more than the woman's medical records, the patient's medical records, any letter of appeal she's written often without the help of a lawyer, and then the insurance company's consultant's reports. In most cases, consultants who have never met the patient, who have never examined the patient. And the judge, when there is a discretionary clause, the rule of law is this. The judge must, without conducting a trial, a jury trial, without bringing in experts or ever meeting the patient, the judge must uphold that decision by the insurance company if the decision is plausible, unless it is an abuse of discretion. Whereas if there is not a discretionary clause, the case is reviewed de novo. And what does de novo mean? It's the civil standard we're all used to. It's the preponderance of the evidence standard. And what this bill does is it levels the playing field so that consumers who are denied benefits under health policies, disability policies, et cetera, so when they go into court, they are subject to a preponderance of the evidence standard, still a cold record review, still no jury trial. But at least they get this de novo standard, which is where a judge reads the policy and determines whether that claimant has met their burden of proof. So it sets a standard that is the standard we're all familiar with in the civil justice system, in the civil trial system. The final thing that it does is when the standard of review is abuse of discretion, the common law rule that applies in American jurisprudence that a vague or ambiguous term in an insurance policy is construed against the insurance company, that rule goes out of the window when you have review for abuse of discretion. It's just fundamentally unfair. The party, that rule is designed to protect the consumer. When an insurance company writes the policy, if it imposes a term that is vague or ambiguous, it is fair that that term be construed against the insurance company and in favor of the consumer. And eliminating, banning discretionary clauses brings that fairness rule back into the judicial review. Happy to answer any questions. It's a complex issue, but
did you? I want to make sure I heard you correctly.
Certainly.
You seem to be saying that Senate Bill 317 is a model law that was adopted by the Association of whatever it's called, insurance states, insurance commissioners.
Yeah, exhibit the first exhibit to the materials I submitted, and I submitted these by email today, has the Model Act, and the Model Act is a prohibition on discretionary clauses. That was passed unanimously by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners back in 2001. And it was after that that states one by one started enacting legislation, passing rules to ban these clauses.
Would this preclude an insurance company from using arbitration?
No.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next person, Tom Simpson. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom Simpson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Standard. Standard was founded in 1906 in Oregon and remains headquartered here today. We employ over 3,000 individuals, most of those in Oregon, and that we have about 7 million insurance and retirement plan customers nationwide. This proposed legislation concerns a complex and technical aspect of trust law that has been addressed by federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, in countless cases. I am not an expert in trust law, and I'm not here to educate the committee on the law of trusts. I will simply say that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly endorsed the right of those purchasing group benefit plans to grant discretionary authority to their insurance administrator. This legislation intersects not just federal common law, which is continually evolving, but also with ERISA, as you heard before, Employee Retirement Income Security Act. The U.S. Department of Labor is the chief regulator for ERISA and regularly engages in rulemaking concerning these matters. Discretionary clauses are currently the subject of a rulemaking by the Oregon Insurance Division, the state's chief regulator for insurance matters. The rulemaking is ongoing and has involved a wide swath of Oregon's insurance industry, interested trial lawyers, and consumer advocates. The rulemaking included an advisory committee and a public hearing and is currently undergoing a formal comment period. The Standard is actively engaged in this rulemaking and has offered comments in support of this division, the division's rulemaking. While we certainly do not dispute the legislature's ability to act in this arena, we think that this matter is best suited for regulatory rulemaking by experts in the subject matter. This legislation is a shotgun approach to a nuanced and technical issue. Were this a case where the regulator was asleep at the wheel or derelict in their duty to police an industry, we would be at the table with the legislature to craft a remedy. This is not such an instance, and we respectfully request that the legislature allow the insurance division to manage this complex matter and the industry they are charged with regulating. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Riley.
So is the insurance division rule different than what this bill proposes?
I would have to defer to the Oregon Insurance Division on that question. Senator Byer, Chair, Senator Riley. Sorry. I don't know the detail of that, Senator.
Oh. So you're testifying that the insurance division's rulemaking is better than this, but you don't know what it is? I'm confused.
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, what I'm saying is that the insurance division has undertaken this rulemaking already. They're right in the middle of it, that we're asking for that rulemaking to continue and finish up before the legislature comes in and passes this law.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator. Yeah, what I kind of heard you say is this is very complex law, and that the people that know about it should be making the rules, not be in the insurance division. That's kind of what I heard from you. That's pretty much a summary
Chair
of
Byer,
what you're saying.
Yeah, so Vice Chair Gerard, I agree.
This is currently in the rulemaking right now, mm-hmm. and you would like to allow them to do their job, and then if there's deficiencies to follow suit. I tried reading this stuff, and it's very complex. It's way over my head. So I kind of think that I would like to leave it to the experts.
Anybody else? Senator Thompson.
I read the material, too, and I fully understand it. I still think the insurance division should handle this, even though I'm an expert on it.
And there's nothing we will suggest you as the insurance commissioner.
No.
Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Knapp? I couldn't tell if it was an A or an O. There's a Knapp or Knapp?
Yeah,
Knapp. Knapp, okay.
Pat Heidenreich.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Byer and members of the committee. My name is Michael Knapp. I'm an attorney. My practice specializes in representing policyholders in disputes with their own insurance companies. Including all different kinds of policies, including fire policies or when an insurance company doesn't want to defend an insured that's been sued. But I do a lot of work in the health, life, and disability insurance coverage area. Most Oregonians get their health, life, and disability insurance through their employment as a benefit from their employment. And if your insurance coverage comes as a benefit through a benefit from your employment, any disputes about whether a claim should be made are covered by federal ERISA law. Federal ERISA law can be complex, but in that sense, it's very simple. If you have an employment-based policy, you get your coverage through your work, then it's going to be covered by federal ERISA law if there is a dispute. The only exceptions to that is if it's a government employer or if it's a church employer. But other than that, if you have your insurance through your work, your coverage disputes are subject to federal ERISA law. The law is simple on this point, very simple. If an insurance company puts a discretionary clause in their policy, they get two huge advantages, both at the claim review process and if you end up in court. If there's a discretionary clause in the policy, the only way the insured can get the claim to stick if they take it to court later is to prove that the insurance company's decision was not wrong, but so bad that it was arbitrary and capricious, or that it was abuse of discretion. That, from the insured's perspective, is a huge barrier to pursuing court relief for a claim. I tell people that all the time. You may have a meritorious claim. You may be in a gray area and we could fight it. But if you go to court, you have to not have the preponderance of evidence like everywhere else. Now, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's this abuse of discretion standard. There's a huge burden for you to overcome before the judge to convince the judge way beyond you're right and it should be paid. You have to convince the judge that the insurance company was so wrong in their decision that it was arbitrary and capricious. And that is a very, very tough standard to overcome. And all they have to do, it's simple, put a discretionary clause in their policy. Under federal ERISA law, you then get abusive discretion review. The second thing that gives a great advantage to the insurance company and disadvantage to policyholders is the normal rule, which is followed in every state and in every federal court, except in ERISA cases, is that if there's some ambiguity in the terms of the policy, and there's a dispute about whether a claim should be paid, and it arises from that ambiguity, then the normal rule is the ambiguity is construed in favor of the insured. The basic idea is simple. The insurance company writes policies. They put the terms in the policies. If they want to deny a claim based on some term, it cannot be an ambiguous term. And that's a rule that's followed everywhere. However, again, very simply, if you put a discretionary clause in the policy, the insurance company does in a group policy, then the rule switches. The normal rule is if there are two reasonable interpretations of how to construe the terms of a plan that are disputed, if both sides have a reasonable one, you construe it in favor of the insured. It's considered to be ambiguous if there's two equally good interpretations. Under the ERISA law, with a discretionary clause, if there are two equally reasonable interpretations, the insurance company wins because all they have to show is that it is a reasonable interpretation. The court can think the insured has just as reasonable one, or the court can even think the insured has a more reasonable interpretation. But that doesn't get them there. The insurance company gets to win if there is any reasonable interpretation at all, regardless of whether the insured has one as well. And I tell people, and it happens many, many times, I would say a third to a half of the cases I'm involved in, is what does this policy term mean? How do you construe it? What is the kind of insurance coverage that's going to be paid for in one fashion or another? You have to look at the terms of the policy. And can you see from those terms whether it's going to be excluded or not, or whether it's going to be covered or not? And I tell people all the time, if there's any ambiguity in there and you've got an ERISA case, the hurdle is too big for you. And I turn away people all the time who I think have meritorious claims. And if they were in state court where the normal insurance rules would apply, we would have a great case. But you have to turn people away. And I've got two cases in my office right now, one close to $500,000 on an accidental death policy, and another one on a brain injury policy, where, having read the case law, whether my client is going to win or not depends on what standard of review applies and what the rules are in terms of the interpretation of ambiguities in the policy. So it is, I want to get back to, this is a simple matter that you're dealing with, and a very important one from the insured's perspective, because with the discretionary clauses in the policies, the deck is stacked against you as an insured. And I also want to make this comment, following up on what Ms. Glore said. The insurance division has had forms that you're supposed to fill out with checklists on the forms that your policy do and do not have certain things. One of the things on the checklist, and I want to say it's been about 10 years now, is if your policy has a discretionary clause, it cannot give you discretion to interpret the terms in your favor, words to that effect. And they're supposed to check yes or no. So presumably, if they're being candid and accurate in their submissions, they will check yes if there is a discretionary clause and no if there is not. And the problem is what we're finding is, I would say three-quarters, nine-tenths of the group policy I have in my office now and have had for the past 10 years, it includes a discretionary clause. They're just being put in there despite the rule that you're supposed to check yes if you have it in there, and they're still issuing the policies with the discretionary clauses. Now, the other thing I want to point out is the rulemaking that is going on at the insurance division right now is banning banning discretionary clauses with an exception. This isn't going to apply to group policies. It guts the whole purpose that we're all talking about here. And that's why we're very concerned that we somehow delay getting the legislature where what's before the insurance division now bans discretionary clauses but excludes those that apply to ERISA, which is where it is so fundamentally needed. So that's all I have, unless there's questions.
So to be clear, if it's an employer-provided policy, it's covered by ERISA.
Yes, unless it's a state policy, government, or church.
Say that again?
The only exceptions, all employment-based policies, except if your employer is a government agency or a church.
Oh, okay. So if it's state employees, or are the policies that cover the legislature aren't covered by this?
Exactly.
But
to your benefit, sir.
And if it is an ERISA policy, then any challenge has to be placed in federal court.
Yes. One of the rules is ERISA, very fundamental one. If it's an ERISA policy, it must be handled in federal court. And I want to, again, add to Ms. Glor's comment. When you go to court, you don't get to call witnesses and call the doctors and explain why that treatment is medically necessary or not. You have no trial. You have no witnesses. All the judge does is review the paper trail that was created in the insurance company's administrative review, which very often is without the assistance of attorneys and, frankly, has insurance companies who know how to create a favorable record for themselves. So that's all the review you get, and all the judge says is, well, was it an abuse of discretion as reflected by what's in the paper trail?
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said, I believe, that the court or the judge will find in favor of the insurance unless it's arbitrary or capricious.
Yes. So
those were your terms?
Yes.
So if the insurance company does the same in every case, it can't be arbitrary, even if it's wrong.
I'm not sure what you're asking. Please talk.
If a judge would find, if this were not a discretionary case,
yes,
that this should go for the insured,
yes.
If the insurance company does the same thing for every insured under this policy with the same kind of claim, then the judge would have to say it's not arbitrary, even if it's goes against what he would normally rule.
Yeah, I guess the best way I can answer that is I've often seen opinions where judges say, I've looked at the evidence, I've looked at the record, I believe, or where's the effect, that this is a close call, or regardless of my belief that the claim would ordinarily be paid, the rules I have to follow is I cannot rule that the claim should be paid unless I find the decision to deny it so bad that it was arbitrary and capricious, and I can't find that. And therefore, I'm upholding the denial of that.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I got one.
Senator.
Oh, thank you. The question I'm just trying to sum, it doesn't sound like you have much faith in the insurance division, because this is before the rulemaking committee there, and you want us to pass this bill, which basically solves this problem. And is that pretty much a summary of what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. I think, first of all, it's important for the legislature to speak for the people of the state of Oregon and decide what the rule should be on the case. And with all due respect to the insurance division, they're dealing with what is before them now. And what has been put before them now includes a ban on discretionary clauses, but excludes from the ban any policy subject to ERISA.
Well, everything I understand is that the discussions are open-ended right now.
Yes, it's ongoing now, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's open-ended. So there's nothing to say that you're not going to get even more than you're asking for in this bill. It's just those are the people that are experts. I'm a dentist, and if you came here to argue, should something be an MOBL
overlay versus a three-quarter crown, you wouldn't have the slightest idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We don't have the slightest idea what this is about, and you want us to overturn rulemaking from the insurance carrier.
Okay, well, I guess I would say that what the insurance company is dealing with now, and the problem has been brought to them, because what's happened is they've said, fill out the forms appropriately, acknowledge if you have a discretionary clause. In essence, don't include it in your policies, but that's happening anyway. I don't know who wrote the bill or the rule that's before them now, but I know that in there now is one that guts what we think is the most important thing about it. I would also say this. The federal courts want to know what the states think. And if the federal courts are looking and saying, okay, we're not going to enforce a discretionary ban because the state has decided they're not lawful, in my view, a legislative decision to that effect is going to be much more powerful and much more long-lasting and much more effective for the policyholders.
Mark? Oh, I'm good.
That's Senator Wright.
Yes, just a comment. I always have believed that in any case where there's a difference of opinion or that the rulemaking may not cover the situation or may. I've always believed that there should be a legislative decision.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Reverend.
Paul Trudell. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Paul Turtle, and I'm a resident of Northwest Portland. I'm actually a couple of other things. I'm a consumer. I'm not an attorney. I have been, just as a volunteer, been active as a volunteer consumer advocate for many different consumers working on insurance issues over the last 5 years. Basically just got started because I had some success with my own kids resolving some insurance complaints, and other parents kept asking me for help, and things just kind of took off, and I think I've helped about 150 people so far with various different issues, and I've worked very closely with Insurance Commissioner Cowley and a number of other people. The Senate Bill 317 addresses several issues that technical issues that we have worked through over the years. I'm actually the originator of this. I'm the one who asked this to be considered along with House Bill 2857, its equivalent on the House side. I have a couple of exhibits in this one in OLIS. It's the Paul Turdall 2 document I'll refer to briefly. The key things in terms of why we're doing the statute is the question, why are we doing this when we have rules in a form? I've been discussing this legislation with the insurance commissioner for several years, and in particular last summer, I had a couple of meetings with Insurance Commissioner Cowley and her team really over the question, should we do rules or should we do statute? She's here and she can follow up further on that. The fundamental problem is that the insurance commissioner's current authority is over a disapproval of forms. The insurance commissioner is required to disapprove forms that have deceptive language in it. The problem, as Mickey was just pointing out, is that if something slips through that screening, it's binding, and her authority to take action on it after it has gotten through is over. And there are, we discuss possible scenarios. This is the form that Mickey was referring to. It's in my Exhibit A in the document. I've highlighted in yellow, the key part they have to check off. And, the problem is insurers, they'll go through here, they'll check off, confirm, yep, we comply with that, and then they put them in anyway. And, theoretically, we could pursue them for falsifying documentation, do criminal proceedings. That would be a bit messy. What I discussed with the insurance commissioner is we'd just be a lot more productive if we were a lot clearer, both in terms of rules and in terms of the statute for how we dealt with that. Commissioner Cowley, my understanding is she moved ahead with the rules, knowing this bill was coming, having seen the draft language in July on this bill, because she simply did not want to wait. There were insurers who were challenging her authority to remove these discretionary clauses, and she simply did not want to wait. She wanted something immediately so that she could take action for the formal approval process this year. Now, so the rules are certainly very helpful, and I think it is a great thing about a part of that process. The public comment period is closing on Friday, and my reading of the rules that are in process and the various comments that have come in, as well as the language of the statute, is that they are not at all inconsistent, and that the rules, you know, the language in the statute was basically taken from the current form of the current process that insurers were already doing, and the rules would simply be an elaboration upon that. If this committee wanted to wait another week or two until the insurance commissioner was done with that process, I don't think there would be any harm in that. But, you know, the bill as it is quite consistent with that existing authority and no way undermines her ability to do those rules. So we need to have the statute in addition to the rules, because her sole authority, even with the rules, is to refuse approval of a form. It does not extend to going after a form that has slipped through that process if an insurer has either made a mistake or fudged their filing. So that's one key thing. A couple of other things in here. The second part, which we haven't really discussed much, is the requirement that insurers affirmatively declare compliance with the insurance code. This should be a no-brainer. I actually was very happy to see some of the questions and some of the written testimony from insurers saying, well, we already put that in our contract. What's the problem? And the problem is that while some insurers do that, some don't. And we did have a court case a year ago where an insurer flat out said, and this is included in Exhibit C in here, doesn't matter if our contract doesn't comply with the Oregon law, you can't address that in court. This is our contract, and the court has no authority to intervene. Now, thankfully, the judge disagreed with that insurer and citing a variety of common law statutes in the judge's decision as excerpted here in Exhibit C, to basically say, you know, based on common law and common sense interpretation, no, I can look at it. What we wanted to do is basically affirmatively knock that argument out so we don't have insurers coming after us and saying, you can't complain that we're breaking the law because it doesn't matter, which is what they were doing. The last piece in here I'll have Keith Ivanovich will be talking about in a little bit would be related to the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment was intended in our original filing for this bill. It basically makes it gives the insurance commissioner direct enforcement authority over the insurance coverage mandates in Chapter 743A. That's the Dash 2 amendment, and engrossing that amendment would conform the bill with the House version 2857. There is a Dash 3 amendment that we have seen, which simply changes the implementation date. Well, I don't know that it's necessary. I don't really have any objections to it. I think it's just going to be a matter of a couple of months in terms of when this goes live, and if the insurers feel the need a couple of extra months to work on this, I don't think it's a significant issue. So with that, if there are any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Keith Dubanovich. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Drodd, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. The last time I came before you was probably when I was Associate Attorney General a couple of years ago. I'm here primarily to address the Dash 2 amendment. Happy to answer any questions, but I'm not an expert in ERISA, and I'll admit that. This issue most recently came to my attention when some healthcare providers came to me to ask for assistance in getting reimbursement for some care that they had provided. And when I looked at the mandates under Oregon law, it was not clear to me what the enforcement mechanism is. Under Chapter 743A, there are dozens of required reimbursements. They range from emergency services to services provided by an optometrist, dental surgery, expanded practice dental hygienists, mammograms, and prostate screening. So those are things that are mandatorily required to be covered in an insurance policy here in Oregon. However, when I looked at each of those mandatory provisions, there wasn't a clear enforcement mechanism. In other words, I looked at them and I said, okay, well, what can I do about it? And the answer I concluded was, I can't do anything about it. It's unclear where you would go. And what the amendment does is make it clear that if you don't provide the required reimbursement, it is simply a violation of the unfair claim settlement practices and therefore is enforceable by the insurance commissioner. So to answer a question that Senator Girard asked last week about another bill, I have no financial interest in this bill. It's not going to help my practice at all. What it will do is help healthcare providers get reimbursement for care that they're already providing. It does not place any new obligations on any insurance company or any providers. The law is already clear that you have to cover these things. All it does is clarify how the mandatory reimbursements are going to be enforced. So unless there are further questions, I'm happy to give back your time.
Thank you, Keith. Questions? Got off easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Lana Butterfield. Welcome again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today just on behalf of American Family Insurance Company. You've heard previous speakers talk a lot about life insurance and health insurance, but nobody has mentioned property casualty, and so I'd like to give you our perspective. For property casualty insurers, Senate Bill 317 is a solution in search of a problem. As far as we know, there are no discretionary clauses in most property casualty policies. And in fact, in American Families policies, the language that is suggested to be reprinted in Senate Bill 317 is unnecessary because a form of that language exists already in our policies. And my written testimony gives you the language that is in our policy. It's expensive to reprint and then especially to mail unnecessary language out to all of our existing customers. Plus, we would have a compliance problem. This is something that takes a while, especially for carriers like American Family, who are not, you know, on the web. Their policies aren't on the web and so forth, to comply with. And we would ask respectfully for some more time. You heard a previous witness say that he didn't have any problem with us asking for more time. And so I have submitted on behalf of American Family the Dash 3 amendment, asking that the operational date be moved to January 1st, 2016. The emergency clause would remain on to give the insurance division authority to go ahead with its rulemaking. But we do ask, please, that you would adopt the Dash 3s. Thank you.
Thank you, Lana. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. That is all that I have scheduled or signed up. Is there anybody else? Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. I signed up 2 years ago, which was last week for me. list disappeared. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the model rules that you've heard about address life health policies, and to my knowledge, none of them address directly property and casualty. The rule that's being promulgated by the insurance division does indeed do that. We believe that the rule should govern at least for the next year or so in case there are unforeseen circumstances in the property casualty area. You mentioned arbitration. Depending on how the words come out,
of that rulemaking, and we have submitted some comments on that. Depending on how those words come out, it could present a problem, which could be addressed by rule instead of waiting for the legislature to reconvene. So we're hoping that the legislature will go slow in this regard, look at the rule that's being promulgated and study that before taking action. Should the legislature desire to take action, we would hope that the prescribed language in the bill would be taken out. The law would be you cannot have discretionary clauses. This bill requires us to put in there we can't have discretionary clauses and print that in the policy form, and we don't think that's necessary language to go into the policy form. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Paul. Questions?
Senator. Would you be opposed if we gave the insurance commissioner greater latitude and a rulemaking authority? That seems to be some of the problem, that this just involves forms. That would seem to put other issues on the table. I think everybody wants a fair mix between insured and insurers, and that seems to me to be the solution, would be to just give more latitude to the insurance commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, that we would not object to the commissioner given direct legislative authority in this area.
Okay, great, thanks.
Any others? Thank you, John. Elise?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP. It's the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And our members have several concerns I wanted to mention to you that lead to our opposition on Senate Bill 317. I'm not going to beat a dead horse, but the three that have been mentioned already, again, OID's process is underway. The rulemaking process is underway, and it has been over the last greater part of the year. And the rule is about to be enacted once the public comment portion is over with, and we support the rule. Issue number two for us is that this bill goes beyond what the rule is saying. It goes beyond the NAIC language. As John Powell just stated, it's asking for additional language, additional unnecessary language to be added to all contracts. And then third mentioned, the implementation date is a issue for health insurance carriers. The bill becomes effective 91 days after it passes, and our 2015 policies are already locked in. They're locked in today. And by the time this bill passes, 2016 policies will be locked in. So the dash 3 implementation date of January 1, 2016 doesn't help us. We would need to ask for an additional amendment that would give us January 1, 2017. So those are my concerns, and wanted to share those on behalf of the health insurance carriers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions, sir?
If the language saying we have to put we can't put discretionary clauses in, if that language was not required, do you still need an extra year?
We do. As you heard from an earlier witness, Senator Riley, is that causes the impetus for the carriers to have to reprint. All of that causes administrative new burden, and we'd need some time to deal with that.
So the act of having to take out the discretionary clause would cause you to have to do that.
Discretionary clauses are already not allowed, Senator Riley. But my point is that this bill would ask us to add additional language.
My question was, if that were not, if your second point which was we have to add this additional language to it. If that was not in there, do you still need the 2 years?
Yes, we do, because, again, Senator Riley, what we need to do is to change the current forms and contracts that we have to add that additional language. So that, maybe I'm sorry. I'm missing your question.
I'm asking you, if you did not have to add that additional language, which says we can't put in discretionary clauses because that's what the language is, if you did not have to insert that language, do you still need the 2 years?
We do.
For what?
We, as I stated, the health insurance carriers submit rate filings.
There you go.
And so that is all of our new contracts that go out, and that's at the request of the Oregon Insurance Division.
Got that.
Right? So the 2015 policies are in place right now with those forms. The 2016 policies are going to be decided as of the middle of April per the Insurance Division's request. So again, we're going to be locked in by the time this bill is printed. We're going to be late to the party here on this. So I'm asking that we would need rather than, you've heard the comments supporting an implementation date that's later, I'm asking for an additional year because of our rate filings.
Okay.
More? Senator.
Yes, I'm going to ask you the same question. You know, they've brought up the problem that the forms are the only latitude that the insurance commissioner had. So if we were to give the insurance commissioner greater latitude in this arena, would you have any problems?
Senator Girard, I would not. We would appreciate that.
Great. Thank you.
More. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify?
Well, Commissioner Kelly.
Do you want to testify now, or would you like to think about it until?
I'm happy to answer questions or clarify.
Okay, please.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner, and I have to say it's a wonderful feeling to sit in a room and just hear yourself talked about for about a half an hour. thank you very much for inviting me up. And if you wouldn't mind, maybe I could clarify a couple of things in terms of where we are on the current rulemaking, just kind of give you a rundown of the facts, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Please.
If that's helpful. So as you've heard, we're in the midst of rulemaking. We have had a long-standing ban on discretionary clauses. We do rely on pretty general authority. You've heard many folks talk about that already. And the difficulty for us, it's actually not just as simple as insurers check the box and then we make sure that we look at the box and that the right one's checked. We do review the policy forms as well. But the policies, if you ever had to read, you know, hundreds and thousands of pages of insurance policy language, is very dense. And, you know, we're human, and occasionally we miss things. And the other thing that happens, too, is that we have some real intense battles with some of the carriers about whether this is truly a discretionary clause that gives sole discretion to the insurer. It's pretty complex language, as you might see when you read some of these. So I would say that our success has not been as strong as we would like, and oftentimes we don't have we haven't had something in rule or in statute to say this is exactly where it says you can't do this. And so that was the impetus for us to embark on the rulemaking, is for us to have something more clear that would more specifically clarify the general authority that we were using to require that contracts be clear and, you know, understandable and fair to the consumer. And so we embarked on this rulemaking. We've talked a little bit about using a National Association of Insurance Commissioner model as a starting point. As I understand it, that model focuses on life and health insurance, and the rules that we're proposing are currently broader than that. They do include property casualty, where this comes up in kind of a different context, but one of the points that we've asked the public to comment on with the proposed rules is, you know, are there enough nuances with property casualty that we need to embark on a separate conversation around that. So that's something we've solicited comment on. We've also heard some testimony about the issues around ERISA and around the application to group. And I will confirm that the proposed rules that are out there right now include an exemption for ERISA. But as you've heard, there's a lot of differing opinions on this. And it's something that we were receiving comment on and looking specifically at and doing some additional research because we're concerned about that as well.
Could you, on your existing authority, issue a rule which would preempt ERISA is probably not the right word, but give you the authority to review that, or give a state court the authority to review?
Chair Beyer, I would need to confirm in terms of the issues about what it would do in terms of the court review. I think we can write a rule that requires contracts filed in the state to meet certain requirements, and it may possibly be influential if there were an appeal in an ERISA environment, but I would need to confirm about what the extent of our ability would be.
Could you insert either through existing rules or with the additional authority the ability to set up an arbitration process, either through the division or establish that as an option rather than the courts?
Chair Beyer, just to clarify, are you talking about specifically for ERISA or
discretionary
broadly?
Clauses?
Broadly for any discretionary clauses.
Broadly. I'm just fishing for information.
Sure. Chair Beyer, I'm happy to take a look at that and get back to you. I think with respect to ERISA, it's a little bit more complex because you do have the federal, that if there's an issue or an appeal, it ends up at the federal level. But, you know, there are things that can be done in terms of what our requirements are for contracts in Oregon. So I'm happy to get back to you.
That conflict between ERISA and federal jurisdiction versus states would seem to be at issue in this bill if we were to apply it to group health policies.
Chair Beyer, I'm happy to get back to you with a little bit more specificity on that point. And I just wanted to make one other key point. The rulemaking, because we're in active rulemaking right now, the comment period closes at the end of this week, and then we're going to review all of the comments. And if we need to conduct additional research or ask for further comment, we have that ability. But I think as you've heard today, this is a pretty, I'd say a serious and also an ongoing issue. And so we saw the need to address it sooner rather than later with the rules, and particularly as we see health benefit plans being filed with us soon, we felt the need to act.
So when do you think you would be in a position with your rules closing at the end of the week to determine whether you would recommend legislation or comment on your authority to address these issues?
Chair Beyer, I think we may be able to comment on our authority to address these issues sooner and likely, as early as next week. I think it would be appropriate for us to have a little bit of time to review the comment. Right now, I know we have some, but sometimes we get a few kind of close to the end of the deadline. So I would say maybe, early March would be a good time.
Yeah, we're going to be around here for a few months. Senator.
Yes, you've heard my questions about giving you a little bit more latitude. Do you feel like you need a statute giving you the authority in rulemaking with a little broader latitude, or are you okay the way it is? I know he asked a similar question, but I'm just going to lay it back on you and see what you say.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard. I think it can be helpful to have, a little bit more, the intent of the legislature behind us when we're doing rulemaking, as evidenced by the fact that we're undergoing rulemaking. I think we have the authority to do this, it can't hurt to underscore that.
So when you report back, if you need that, maybe an amendment or a separate bill even, the committee could drop a bill and take care of that maybe. Or we could amend this one. I don't know what the related.
I think we want to wait and give the commissioner a couple of weeks to get through her rulemaking and see what's there.
I totally agree. I'm just.
Yeah, I agree.
Makes sense to me.
All righty. Any other questions for the commissioner? Thank you very much. Really appreciate the job you're doing. A great job, the insurance division. So
thank you very much.
It.
Good luck in making these two sides agree.
All right. So. Colleagues, I think what we're going to do is I think we will set this one over for a couple of weeks so that we give the commissioner time to find out what people are saying and also give each of you a chance, if you choose to talk with the commissioner independently about questions you might have in this. So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 317, excuse me. And I apologize to those who are here for the other bills on the agenda. We will carry those over. And we do have a couple of introductions, so I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. The chair moves legislative council drafts 2909 and 3160 be introduced as committee bills. And again, for the record, this does not imply either support or opposition to the bill or commit you in any way to future support or opposition. It's just to get them into the process. Motions on the floor. Is there discussion? Is there any opposition? The LC 2909 and LC 3160 are introduced as committee bills. Close the work session. Is there anything else to do today? We are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you all. We are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you all.